Hello and welcome into this edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity. Hoping you are having a wondrous day and that you had a great weekend, that you and yours are doing well. It is the 12th day of October 2020. As I said, it is Monday, and today is Columbus Day, or as the progressives celebrate it, Indigenous Peoples Day. And they're trying to erase Columbus from our history, which I think is really interesting. And I'll dig into that here in just a few minutes. But first up, how you doing? I hope you're doing well. I hope everything is good with you and that your weekend was awesome. And around our place, our weekend was... I kind of like these weekends because it means we've been doing some R&R and rest and recuperation. And that's exactly what we did over the weekend. Aside from your basic housework, you know, just washing clothes and cleaning up around the house and the like, our weekend was really, really uneventful. And that's always a good thing. At least it is for us, because it means that we got a chance to do some rest and some recovery, and we just took a deep breath and enjoyed things. And it was good. It was really good. I'm trying to think if there was anything to talk about, and I don't think there is, because we, let's see. I don't think after going to grab fajitas Friday night, I don't think we left the house at all weekend, except to, you know, go out in the yard with the dog. But I think that was it. I think we actually were homebodies. We stayed here. We did nothing but, you know, clean the house, dust, vacuum, straighten up, wash clothes, that sort of a thing. And that was our weekend. That and watching stuff on TV. We've been going to church online for quite some time, so we continued that. What else did we do? We just watched YouTube videos. I introduced my wife Jane to the beginnings of the Kara and Nate series on YouTube, and we watched. She's seen a handful of them, but she hasn't seen as many as I have, and so I went back and reintroduced her to their beginnings and showed her. She would say, oh yeah, I've seen this one. And we would skip the ones that she'd seen and move on to the ones that she hasn't seen so that she could catch up. And the reason is that that Kara and Nate, a couple from Nashville who spent 4 years on the pursuit of visiting 100 countries around the world, are just an adorable couple. Kara is one of the most joyful people I've ever seen. Her husband, Nate, is he has a master's in business administration, so he has that kind of brain, that analytical brain. He's useless when it comes to working on things, so to speak, around the house or repairing a car or something like that. But when it comes to the ins and outs of planning things, he's a genius. And between the two of them and their cameras and their drone, they have made some really, really great travel videos, and we've been enjoying seeing the places they've been going and getting back to their roots as far as the way things have gone for them. And we enjoyed that. And I'm enjoying walking my wife back through the history of things that she hasn't seen. I've seen all of them. We're caught up now. They're doing the van life trip across America now, where they bought a secondhand customized Sprinter van that had been turned into essentially a camper. And now and it was actually the van was converted by a couple, not professionals, who just put it together. They wanted it to be the way they wanted it to be so they could live in it while they traveled around. And then all of a sudden, bing, baby's coming along and they can't travel. So Kara and Nate bought their van, and now they're traveling across the country and getting involved in things. And one of the things they recently this year got involved with was that Nate biked the Colorado Trail with his brother and a friend. And the Colorado Trail is 500 miles of trail that is normally hiked, and some people mountain bike it. And he did the mountain bike route. Over 500 miles. Over. It was 570-something miles of mountain trails on a mountain bike. And it was brutal. And watching it was brutal. But he decided to dive into it, to challenge himself, to do it, and he did it. And it was amazing. And it wasn't like he just set out and spent 500 miles consistently. They would do a segment or a couple of segments a day, and they would crash in the RVs at night, in the vans at night, and then get up in the morning and take off again. And their wives and the kids would meet them in the vans as the support team for lunch, and they'd hit the trail again. And it was an interesting way to do it. And it took them better than 3 weeks to accomplish the task. And watching the videos wow. It was just, like I said, it was at times it was tough to watch. But they have come off of that now, and they're getting ready to get into some more adventures. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that goes. They've fixed some of the problems that they've had with the van that they discovered early on now. And they're getting ready to head along and do some amazing things, I think, here in the United States. And I'm looking forward to more of that. Anyway, how I got off on that. Anyway, that was our weekend. That was catching up, getting Jane, well, not completely because we're just into the first year, and they spent 4 years on the road reaching 100 countries. But and that was it for the weekend. That was it. And here we are faced today with a Monday, it being Columbus Day, it being the beginning of the Amy Comey Barrett hearings. In fact, they were already making their way into the hearing room as I was making my way to the studio. So that's underway already. And that's something that we should all be keeping one eye on. And in just a moment, because I got sidetracked right before the show started, as usual, I didn't have my TV set up. So in the first break, I'll do that so that I can keep one eye on what's happening in the hearings. And maybe we'll deal with it a little bit tomorrow morning for the next edition of the podcast. But first up, it's Columbus Day, and I wanted to deal with that to begin with very quickly. After a summer, this is from this is from a site called cityjournal.org, and it's an article by Dave Seminara. It's called "Don't Defend Columbus, Celebrate Him." Now, I'm not going to read all of it. I'm going to pull excerpts, okay, because it gets into some political things, and I don't really want to get deep into that. But I will start with the first paragraph. After a summer of assaults on Christopher Columbus's legacy, it's a small miracle that Columbus Day is still hanging on as a federal holiday. Columbus has been under attack since at least 1980, when Howard Zinn vilified him in his anti-American polemic, A People's History of the United States. More recently, Columbus's reputation has come under attack like never before. Dozens of Columbus statues have been vandalized, and at least 33 cities have taken down their Columbus statues from Sacramento to New Haven. In June, a 1,600-pound bronze statue of Columbus, located just a few miles from Joe Biden's 6,850-square-foot mansion, was removed. It's unlikely that anyone in the media will ask Biden for his opinion on the matter. According to Lawrence Berggren's Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504, much of the lasting damage to Columbus's reputation came after the publication of Bartolome de las Casas' book, A Short Account of the Destruction of the Indies, in 1542. Las Casas was a priest, but he was no saint. A champion of Native American peoples, he was also a slave owner who proposed exchanging Indian slaves for African slaves. Las Casas has been criticized since his death for presenting an incomplete, partial, and biased portrayal of Spanish rule in America. His skewed account of Columbus's voyages survived largely because it was promoted by England, Spain's rival. Berggren says that Las Casas became a pawn whose account served as a call to arms for Spain's mostly Protestant rivals to save the New World from further horrors. Columbus's voyages to the New World did result in the decimation of the Native American communities that lived under Spanish rule. But this was obviously not a premeditated genocide. Neither Columbus nor anyone alive at the time understood what we know now about infectious diseases and germs. That makes no difference to the woke police, for whom no historical figure born decades or centuries ago can pass muster. Even Mohandas Gandhi apparently expressed racist sentiments as a young man, and some want his statues taken down too. As the Italians say, if you're looking for evil, you'll find it. What if Columbus hadn't embarked on his groundbreaking voyages to the New World? Indigenous tribes weren't living in harmony before his arrival, contrary to popular perception today, and they wouldn't have had the country to themselves for long in any case. There's no reason to believe that they would have been better off if Chinese or Arab explorers, for example, had settled there first instead of Europeans. Tearing down statues of Columbus and replacing Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, as several states and hundreds of municipalities have done, won't save lives, black or otherwise, and it would be an insult to Italian-American families who raised money to honor Columbus with these monuments. We live in a culture that glorifies victimhood, but none of the Italian-Americans I know chooses to embrace this role. While we understand that America isn't perfect, we're grateful that our ancestors got on those boats to cross the ocean, just as Columbus did centuries before. I asked Andre Dimino, a member of the board of the Italian-American One Voice Coalition, which is suing West Orange, New Jersey for taking down a Columbus statue in June, if Italian-Americans have any chance to preserve Columbus Day, given America's culture lurch leftward. He said, of course, because we won't give up. And I hope they don't, seriously. We need to understand the reality of what Columbus did and understand that the woke community in America today is seeking to judge Christopher Columbus by their standards from the year 2020. The world was a very different place back in the late 1500s. It was a very different place. We saw things differently based on what we understood to be true. As time goes by, everything we know shifts and changes based on how we understand the world and the universe around us. We understand, for example, today, that smoking tobacco, is unhealthy. 40 years ago, television, in the evenings as families sat down to watch their television was populated by people who casually smoked cigarettes. 40, 50 years ago, you could visit a doctor's office and find ashtrays. We know differently now. We understand that constant exposure to tobacco smoke is not good for the lungs and can cause cancer. We understand also that is not a universal diagnosis. Not everyone gets it. Not everyone doesn't. We understand it's a problem. And so we treat it as such. Such is the case with many things in our lives today. Even 10 years ago, we accepted some things we don't accept today because we know better. But when it comes to looking at the role of a historical figure like Columbus, the woke crowd throw out that filter of sensibility and judge him based just on their emotions concerning what he did, which were completely acceptable at the time. Just like cigarette smoking was completely acceptable in America and around the world to the degree that doctors smoked in their offices 40 years ago, we know things today we didn't know back then and should act accordingly. The Daily Perspective Podcast, Monday, October 12th, 2020. Well, the Amy Coney Barrett hearings are underway. Let's crank that up here and see if we can hear what they're saying here.
It's 5-4 opinion upholding the law, stating that Roberts, quote, pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning.
Yeah, Dianne Feinstein, a woman in her 80s, still serving in the Senate, who has publicly said that she would take your guns away from you if she could. Just take them. Turn them all in. Give them up. Who clearly has no respect for the Constitution and will reinterpret it any way she wishes to suit her means, her needs, is now speaking. She's, of course, reading her notes. She's... The entire process is sickening to me. It really is, because what they're trying to do is what they tried to do to Brett Kavanaugh. It should be interesting to see whether or not they manage to accomplish anything. The Democrats, I should say, manage to accomplish anything as a result of this, because they're intent on torpedoing Trump's candidate for the Supreme Court. And they don't care. I mean, the only way that they would approve Amy Coney Barrett is if she was a radical leftist. And she's not. So just be prepared. It's going to be an interesting day. They're going to twist many things. They're going to misrepresent everything she has ever said about anything. In short, the Democrats are going to spend the entirety of the meeting lying about Amy Coney Barrett in some way or another, because this is all politics to them. It doesn't matter whether or not she is the right candidate. She's not their candidate. And so they don't want her in office. They don't want her to hold the position. They don't want Trump to have a win. That's what it boils down to, actually, is they're doing everything they can to damage Trump. They have enough problems on their own. I mean, just look at California right now. Public health authorities in California have unveiled a blueprint for a safer economy. Are you ready for this? You got your coffee? Okay. It requires counties to meet new health equity metrics in order to emerge from the current COVID-19 lockdowns. Now, you're probably familiar by now with the situation in California. California has been locked down and shows no signs of unlocking. None, because Gavin Newsom has decided that he knows best what's best for the people of California, and it doesn't matter what anyone else says unless they agree with him. And that's the that's the catch right there. If they agree with him, then he thinks they're right. And so he and his progressive minions keep coming up with more layers to add to the requirements necessary to lift the lockdown in the various stages he says it will be lifted. In the meantime, businesses are packing up and leaving the state. Employees are not being paid. The economy is tanking. It was already in bad shape because the leftists spend more than they can lawfully take from the people. Anyway, that's the way they work. That's how government works. And now they're complicating the process of lifting the lockdown by adding a racial component. It's a broad experiment in social justice. Under the plan, counties must reduce disparities in levels of transmission in low-income, Black, Latino, and Pacific Islander communities before they can move forward with reopening. In effect, local businesses must remain closed until local bureaucrats are satisfied that ill-defined racial quotas have been met. The underlying assumption of the blueprint is that race-based coronavirus disparities are the result of systemic racism. Despite zero evidence that the state's coronavirus policies have been discriminatory. The plan ignores potential differences in culture, behavior, and underlying health, resting instead on the premise that racism is the driving force behind every disparate outcome. The blueprint also subverts the democratic process. Unelected public health officials are restricting essential freedoms, including mobility, worship, and economic activity, without deliberation by the state legislature or the possibility of review or appeal. Unfortunately, the California blueprint is just part of a broader pattern of state governments using public health as a rationale for seizing power. Throughout the pandemic, blue state politicians have appealed to science as justification for long-term economic shutdowns, mask mandates, and other emergency measures, regardless of whether these policies have been sanctioned by state legislators or voters. Science becomes the highest authority. Citizens must obey. Yet, progressive leaders have been willing immediately to jettison science when it conflicts with their pre-existing political priorities. Earlier this summer, leading epidemiologists pilloried conservative lockdown protesters, declaring them a threat to public health, but then endorsed the much larger Black Lives Matter protests following the death of George Floyd in May. In short, they created a policy of science for thee, but not for me. The disproportionate victims of any attempt to race code the criteria for reopening in California will be the poor, the marginalized, and the non-white, the very people whom the equity policies are supposed to help. If, that is, Los Angeles County fails to reopen because it falls short of its health equity metrics, the Zoom class of intellectuals, public health officials, and progressive politicians will celebrate its own good intentions, even as bartenders, waitresses, taxi drivers, and small shopkeepers, many of them minorities, find themselves out of work. The public should be on alert. If the progressive scientific establishment can simply dictate policy outside the democratic process, by appealing to public health equity, a vague concept that can extend to almost every facet of human life, voters may soon find themselves at the mercy of a new soft totalitarianism. Citizens with a basic respect for freedom should resist this new encroachment. It degrades science, language, and democracy all at once, and acknowledges no natural limit to its power. Tyranny in a lab coat would still be tyranny. So we're watching the state of California right now add a racial component to the coronavirus process. It's ridiculous, I know. It's crazy, I know. But this is progressivism. In a process where every person, regardless of race, creed, national background, skin color, every person is a potential victim of a virus, the progressive elitists, the geniuses in government in California, have decided that it's more important to add a racist component to the mix, because they must defend people based on the color of their skin or their ethnicity, their ethnic background. If they don't take that into consideration, it's not fair. It's not right. Well, here's a news flash for the geniuses in California. The coronavirus is colorblind. The coronavirus doesn't care what your nationality, your ethnic background. It doesn't care about any of that stuff. It's a virus. It's a lot like a rattlesnake. It doesn't care who you are or where you came from or where your family's from or what color your skin is. It's still going to bite you. It doesn't base what it does on any of your measurements. It just doesn't, and it never will. But this is the idiocy of progressivism. The progressives look at something like this and find a way to play the hero for the victimized. But it doesn't matter that equally across the board, everyone is a potential victim. It only matters that their chosen victim groups must be defended. That's all that matters. Because progressive politicians, at the cost of life and limb for everybody else, they're going to be the heroes. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for Monday, the 12th day of October, 2020. I was talking about the coronavirus in the last segment and California's idiotic response to it. It makes me wonder how they're going to respond to what the WHO has done, the World Health Organization. You're probably familiar with this by now, that they've not only done a flip-flop, it's more like a backflip. It's just crazy. Coming out of Australia, there's a story from news.com.au. The World Health Organization has backflipped on its original COVID-19 stance after calling for world leaders to stop locking down their countries and economies. Dr. David Nabarro from the WHO appealed to the world leaders yesterday, telling them to stop using lockdowns as your primary control method of the coronavirus. He also claimed that the only thing lockdowns achieved was poverty, with no mention of the potential lives saved. He said lockdowns just have one consequence that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer. He had a lot to say. And fortunately, we've got the audio, so why don't we just let him say what he had to say?
To me, to be a reasonable point.
Really important point by Professor Gupta. I want to say it again. We in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as a primary means of control of this virus. The only time we believe a lockdown is justified is to buy you time to reorganize, regroup, rebalance your resources, protect your health workers who are exhausted. But by and large, we'd rather not do it. Just look at what's happened to the tourism industry, for example, in the Caribbean or in the Pacific, because people aren't taking their holidays. Look what's happened to smallholder farmers all over the world because their markets have got dented. Look what's happening to poverty levels. It seems that we may well have a doubling of world poverty by next year. We may well have at least a doubling of child malnutrition because children are not getting meals at school and their parents in poor families are not able to afford it. This is a terrible, ghastly global catastrophe, actually. And so we really do appeal to all world leaders. Stop using lockdown as your primary control method. Develop better systems for doing it. Work together and learn from each other. But remember, lockdowns just have one consequence that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer.
So says the WHO. And as you remember, you'll accurately recall, the WHO has been the final word on coronavirus for politicians, leftist politicians. So what is Gavin Newsom going to do with this? What's he going to do with what the WHO has just said? Gavin Newsom in the state of California and other leftist progressive governors across America who are holding their citizenry captive now have this to deal with. The WHO is saying, don't use lockdowns. Lockdowns are bad. Lockdowns are hurting people. What will they do? Hard to say. They'll probably ignore the WHO and continue to point to the CDC. And if the CDC changes their opinion based on what the WHO has said, then these progressive people in government will find something else to fall back on. right now, coronavirus, or for the last several months, coronavirus has been very helpful to the progressive cause, because progressives in government have been using it to damage the economies of their states and thus the economy of the nation. And as you have seen in the debates that we have seen over the last few weeks, one of the talking points the Democrats has decided is what they want to use is that this economy is President Trump's fault, that he has failed in his response to the coronavirus, and one of the damages being done by his failure is that the economy is faltering. The problem with that is that it's a lie. The economy is actually coming back, and it's coming back very strong. But the facts don't matter when it comes to progressives. All that matters is the narrative. And they will find whatever they can find to support that narrative. They don't care. What they care about is destroying a president. What they care about is winning a presidential election. And if they can't win the presidential election, they want to do as much damage to the reputation of the president as possible so that the least number of people in America possible will respect the president. This is what they want to do. They even realize that they can't win this election. Stop and think about it. Joe Biden's the best they could have done? Seriously? These people aren't that politically inept. They know Joe Biden can't win. They know he can't. And yet they run him. So they don't care about winning this election as much as they do damaging the president. They just know that they're going to spend the next 4 years doing what they've done for the previous 4 years, and that is constantly, continuously, without let up, lying about the president in order to deceive as many people as possible, to do as much damage as possible to his administration and his time in office. This is what they're concerned with. Please never, ever forget that at the very beginning, in 2016, after the vote was counted, and Donald Trump was the elected president, what did they say? The resistance movement, which is progressive, the resistance movement said they were going to make this country ungovernable. And this has been the attitude of the left since they lost. Remember, they were absolutely certain they had it in the bag. They were certain it was theirs. They were certain that another 4 to 8 years would be theirs in the White House. And in that time, they could entrench themselves into their position and not be able, and no one would be able to take it away from them again. This is what they believed. They had everyone convinced. And we all watched on election night as news caster after newscaster, pundit after pundit, expert after expert, all raised their eyebrows in amazement that Hillary Clinton was losing. They were so certain. Well, now they're not. The polls are lying to us, and we know that because we know how this all works. But now, they're still trying to tell us Trump has no chance. And we're still seeing the contrary, just like we did in 2016. It was hard to find the pictures and video back then, but not now. Back then, the mainstream press wouldn't dignify Trump with reporters with video cameras at the rallies, at his get-togethers. And if they did, they wouldn't show what they saw. We had to search the internet and find pictures from people at those rallies of facilities packed with people. of standing room crowds outside. But they were all over Hillary's gatherings with just handfuls of people there, but they made sure to shoot their video and pictures up close in what looked like huge crowds, but weren't huge crowds. Now that he's president, everything he does is big news. And everybody knows what kind of crowds he's attracting. Bigger crowds than normal. Bigger crowds than last time. And we're also seeing the pictures of the crowds that show up for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Over the weekend, there was a photo that made its way out on social media of the Biden's campaign bus and maybe three dozen people around it holding signs. Giant crowd for Joe Biden. President Trump goes someplace, people camp overnight to be able to get in. Joe Biden goes someplace, he might get 40 people there. I think that tells us a lot. Even factoring in the fear factor, the COVID fear factor, because I know you might be thinking that, well, those people are afraid to go anywhere because they're afraid of COVID. I think those people are just as disgusted. A lot of them are just as disgusted by the overplaying of COVID as you and I are. And if they really believed in Joe, they'd be there. I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. And they're going to continue to lie. Let's just put it that way. They're going to do everything they can to convince as many people as they can that Trump has no chance of winning a second term. But they're going to continue to fight him because they know he's going to win a second term. And today, they're doing exactly that. They're sitting in a meeting room in Washington, D.C. with a candidate for the Supreme Court in front of them. And they're misrepresenting her record. They're misrepresenting everything about her, everything she stands for. They're going to paint her as a dangerous individual who doesn't reflect the opinions and views of Americans. And you know what? That really doesn't matter. What she has to reflect is the opinions and views of the founders and what they wrote, the Constitution. She has to defend the Constitution and not try to reinterpret the Constitution. As I said to you before, she has to be an ump, calling balls and strikes. She's not supposed to be a player in the game. But the Democrats, the progressives, desperately want the next person on the Supreme Court to be a player in the game. They've managed to convince John Roberts to play. And they're hoping that they can kick Amy Coney Barrett out of the dugout and out of the game completely. Because what they want is someone who won't just call balls and strikes. And that's why they're fighting so hard against her. Because her track record shows she doesn't get in the game. She just checks the rules book and calls everything accordingly. And the Democrats can't have that. And here we go, sliding into the final segment for this Monday. And scanning social media during the break. The usual stuff for the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hey, thanks for joining in the fun. I appreciate you being there every day. Thanks for subscribing. If you haven't subscribed, please do. You can do so. You can find the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Podcasting. Pretty much anywhere you can find podcasts, you can find the Daily Perspective Podcast. So go to your favorite supplier of podcasts today and search for the Daily Perspective Podcast. You can possibly search by my name as well, Mark Congleton. You can do that. And then add me to your list and be part of this every day. Give me a couple of weeks. I'll just say that. Give me a couple of weeks. Actually, during the break also, I was putting show notes together, and show notes are actually show notes. That's the references. That's all of the stories that I pull from, because I'm reading through stories and doing commentary along the way. And the stories that I've dealt with today, you'll get direct links to all of those stories so that you can go see those stories for yourself. And that's important because inside of those stories usually are links to other sources. And that gives you this incredible web of information to help inform yourself. It's a very important thing. So make sure you you go over there and take a look today at dailyperspectivepodcast.com and check out the show notes. I post them every day as soon as I get through recording. Now, if you're listening to the podcast, I did this hours ago. I did it early in the morning. And the show notes went up as soon as I got through. So I record from 8 to 9 Central every day, and usually the first thing I do after I say goodbye for the day and take down the live feed and stop the recording, the first thing I do is go over and finalize the show notes, go ahead and put the finishing touches on the show notes, and then publish them. So they go live usually within 5 minutes after I'm through recording. And then within the next 20 minutes, the podcast itself goes up, unless there's some other extenuating circumstances. And speaking of extenuating circumstances, tomorrow I have two outside sessions, both of them occurring in the morning, and I can't do this tomorrow morning. And I'm juggling something else, too. I'm trying to get it moved around, and I'm going to try to see if I can get it moved to some time just after lunch tomorrow, so that as long as I'm on that side of town, I can get this other thing done, because Anyway, I have two conflicting appointments. They're overlapping, and I've got to juggle one of them, and I'm hoping that I can make that happen tomorrow. Yes, it's Wednesday. The Wednesday appointment, those things are bumping against each other too tight for me to be able to make it from one side of town to the other, so I'm trying to move one, since I'll be on that side of town already tomorrow, and see if I can make that happen. Anyway, no podcast tomorrow. And I apologize for that. I just ask you to subscribe, and then I'm telling you, there's not going to be one tomorrow. But there will be one for Wednesday, okay? And the only times I interrupt the flow of the podcast is if I have a schedule interruption, there's illness or something unforeseen happens. And every now and then that does happen. Like we'll have power outages, or things will go crazy, you know, equipment will go down. There was a week not long ago where I spent the week trying to fix computer problems. And it was really frustrating because I had two computers go down in 1 week, and that's something that can happen anyway. But that's it for that. Okay. All right. Let's see. Where was I? Let me ask the dog. Do you know where I was? No, she doesn't know where I was. I was talking about coronavirus and the idiotic response from the Democrats. And now the WHO has chimed in and said, "Hey, don't do lockdowns. It's bad for everybody." Hey, gosh, do they have mirrors? That's what I want to know. And now let's get to creepy Uncle Joe, shall we? He is lying again. And I have to say again, because he has spent his entire 47-year career in politics, but closer to 50 now, just lying. And just by strength of personality has he moved forward. See, he's a pretty dynamic speaker. He's an engaging guy. And if you aren't fact-checking him, odds are you'll vote for him. But if you are fact-checking him, you'll scratch your head and wonder how people could vote for him. It's because they don't fact-check him. Well, now, Democrat presidential nominee Joe Biden has made some false claims. He did this Saturday while he was out speaking to reporters before he got on his campaign plane. He said Republicans are the ones engaged in court packing. Court packing. Now, court packing, the phrase, is a colloquialism. It has been used since the 30s, back when FDR tried to pack the courts. He tried to put more members on the court, on the Supreme Court, that were progressives. So he wanted to shift the balance, increase the number and shift the balance, so that he could get rubber stamp approval for whatever progressive program he wanted to enact. Well, it was a stupid idea. It was an idea that any educated, rational, sane person would say, no, you can't do that. Because it just got, it's what we've been talking about lately, about changing the rules because you can't win the game. Well, FDR was trying to change the rules because he couldn't win the game. Well, that's what Joe Biden and the progressive Democrats want to do today. They want to change the rules because they can't win the game with the rules the way they are. So, they want more justices on the Supreme Court. They want to shift the balance so that most of them are progressives, so that those progressives will ignore the intent of the Constitution, reinterpret it, and rubber stamp whatever they want to do. That's the whole thing. But Joe Biden says the Republicans are the ones engaged in court packing. He claims that what the Republicans are doing isn't constitutional. What are they doing? Well, they're trying to add a ninth justice to the Supreme Court. It's supposed to be nine there. They're missing somebody. So because the Republicans have the White House and they have the Senate, they're moving forward with the process. Nothing unconstitutional about it. Nothing whatsoever. Neither was their refusal to do the same thing with Merrick Garland in 2016. It was their choice not to. They decided not to. Biden made the remarks while he was standing right next to the plane while it was running. It made it kind of difficult to hear his responses. A reporter asked him about his controversial stance of not telling voters before the election whether he supports court packing. The reporter's question came after Biden said, late the other night, voters don't deserve an answer from him on the issue. Quote, court packing before they cast their vote, a reporter shouted at Biden. Wait until after the election? Biden says the only court packing that's going on right now is going on with the Republicans packing the court now. It's not constitutional what they're doing. And to focus on, and there's some inaudible audio, and he goes on to say, focus on what's happening right now. And he coughs. The fact that that's the only packing going on in this court by the Republicans after the vote has already begun. I'm going to stay focused on it so we don't take our eyes off the ball here. And basically what he's trying to do is deflect everybody's attention off of the fact that he, Kamala, and the radical leftists who are standing with them are all in favor of court packing, the Supreme Court. Now, what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that President Trump's appointment of federal justices, he's been filling a lot of vacant positions, a lot. He's been appointing federal conservative justices all over the country into office in all over the country. And they're not happy about that. The progressives aren't, because it means they can't get away with the things they've been trying to get away with at the state and local level. Because they have been surreptitiously behind the scenes, under the radar, they have been putting progressive attorney generals into office in states across America. During the Obama administration, they were putting progressive justices all over the country, judges everywhere, so that anytime they wanted to pull something loony, they could get away with it. Well, Trump's been working to remedy that problem, and they're not happy with it. And that's what they're calling court packing. What Biden said is false. Republicans control the Senate and the White House, and they're well within their constitutional rights to move to fill seats. Nothing that they're doing is unconstitutional. Filling vacant seats is not the same thing as packing the courts. Packing the courts means adding additional seats to the court, talking about the Supreme Court, so that the balance of power on the court is altered. That is what court packing actually is. The federal justice, let's see here, who said this? This was from WBNS Channel 10. They reported the idea of court packing was first introduced by Franklin D. Roosevelt. As I said earlier, he proposed a bill in 1937 to add one justice to the Supreme Court for each justice over the age of 70. The maximum would be six additional justices. The Federal Judicial Center says the move was widely criticized and never enacted. Packing the court now by adding four liberal-minded justices would move it to a 7-6 split that could be more likely to favor Democrats. The catch is that the next time a Republican president and Congress take over, they could decide to add more justices and do the same thing. I would like to correct that last statement. If they succeed in stacking and packing the court, there could never be another Republican administration. Because in the time they would have, because of age, duration of time on the court, in the time they would have, it would be very difficult for Republicans to succeed at anything, because the Supreme Court would challenge everything Republicans wanted to do. And that's the importance of putting Amy Coney Barrett on the court today. And that's all for today. God bless you. Have a good one. We'll see you back here on Wednesday for the next edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.